You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Iran is a country that we've worked on at the Open Society Foundations for something like 18 years. And so it's a country to which we have numerous commitments and consistent dedication over a long period of time. And we've seen various ups and downs with the different comings and goings of the administrations in Iran. And the election last year of President Rouhani seemed to usher in a period of one of the upswings of hope and possibility, both internationally, where, as everyone knows, we're now in the middle of a process, the P5 plus one, negotiating with the Islamic Republic of Iran on its nuclear program, but also with potential for domestic reform, also seemingly indicated by the strong measure of support for a candidate which who didn't seem to be the favored one in the election process as it unfolded last year. The work of the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran stands out as the single most important institutional contribution of organizations focused exclusively on Iran. Of course, there are other groups which pay attention to Iran, including, of course, Human Rights Watch. But this international campaign has a unique capacity and perspective to reflect on the Rouhani administration 1 year on, the role of the human rights community in weighing in on the nuclear negotiations, whether to support a deal or not, and to provide analysis and perspective on domestic developments are critical. So we're very fortunate to have Hadi Qayyemi and his couple members of his board, and Karen, also from ICHRI, here with us today. But we're really looking forward to hearing your analysis. So, Hadi, over to you.
Thank you, Anthony. And let me start by thanking Anthony and Sinai, especially and Open Society Foundation in general, for organizing this talk, giving me the opportunity to share my thoughts on what Anthony already referred to, what has been truly a momentous year that brought the surprise election victory of a centrist cleric, Hassan Rouhani, exactly a year ago in Iran. And already it has ushered in the first significant public engagement between Iran and the West since the inception of the Islamic Republic almost four decades ago. Now, 1 year into his administration, an assessment of his record and the general political context in Iran reveals a decidedly mixed picture, a mixed picture that reflects the deep divide within the Iranian society, and particularly between hardliners and the majority of population who voted for Rouhani. And I'm going to make several key observations that will really show this divide and fracture within this mixed picture. And please, as Anthony said, feel free to interrupt me at any time for any questions or discussions. Now, as we look at this past year, the most important accomplishment we see by Rouhani's administration is on the foreign policy front. And we see that the majority of people in Iran and the political class have united to support him for the nuclear negotiations and end the country's international isolation. Now, Rouhani's success on this front is clear, and it has been pretty much the main aspect of the international media coverage of his administration. He has managed to navigate very skillfully a minefield of hardline opposition to his policies, both in Tehran and in Washington, D.C., to keep these negotiations moving forward and proceed with the country's international rehabilitation. Of course, economic necessity has trumped ideological cleavages within the Iranian regime. And it has provided Rouhani with considerable support and latitude to proceed on this front. On the other hand, when we look more carefully at the domestic front, particularly on the human rights issues, it's been fairly disappointing. Since even though he got elected on a platform to end the widespread repression that particularly intensified after the June 2009 election and the subsequent protests, we haven't seen much improvement. And indeed, if you look at the specific human rights issues, some of them have even worsened. One of the key human rights issues in Iran is the large number of executions. Iran is a leading implementer of death penalty. After China, it's the number two country that carries out most executions. And particularly, there is a lot of concern that these executions result from lack of due process or fair trials. It has been very disappointing that since Rouhani came to power, the number of executions have indeed spiked and increased. Freedom of expression is still under attack. We have had newspapers shuttered under his administration. Peaceful dissent is still prosecuted, and every week we see people sentenced to prison. Hundreds of political prisoners remain behind bars, including many associated with the Green Movement protests. And most notably and significantly is the continued house arrest of the Green Movement leaders that he had promised to bring an end to those house arrests, but it has not happened. Now, to be fair to him, we must note that almost all of these violations are committed by his political rivals, are committed by hardliners whose candidates actually lost in the election a year ago, but they remain in firm control of very key institutions of power, which is the intelligence, security organs, and the judiciary. The judiciary is completely in forefront of politically motivated prosecutions and carrying out many of these human rights violations. Yet, the very fact that Rouhani has kept fairly silent on many of these issues and has not proactively tried to reverse this trend is troubling. His supporters in the country would say that he is indeed working very hard behind the scenes to put an end to these violations, and especially point out to his supposedly lobbying for the release of the Green Movement leaders. Now, regardless of the veracity of this claim, the disconnect between the strong electoral mandate that brought Rouhani to power to ease domestic repression and the lack of progress on human rights front tells us that his political opponents are still quite powerful, and they control key institutions in Iran, and there is a very deep fracture within the political class in Iran. The fact that he hasn't been able to line them up behind his policies, and they're actually using these institutions to undermine him. It's also been noteworthy that just to compare him to the previous reformist president who was in power, Mohammad Khatami, from 97 to 2008, Rouhani has completely stayed away from any discussion or initiation of political or judicial structural reforms. He has not invested any of his capital in that direction. However, We should note that there is one rights issue that he has been very consistent, very vocal, and very public in promoting, and that is the internet, right to access internet and have freedom of expression online and social networking tools, which are very much restricted and filtered inside Iran. He has very cleverly tied, and correctly, tied the development of internet in Iran to economic development of the country, and noting that the global trend and economic development is very much has a direct relationship with how a country uses the internet for its within the society. And this is something for us as human rights advocates to take note, that when a rights issue is tied to a development issue or economic development, then it is there is a constituency strong enough for its robust promotion in Iran. And actually, it looks like that is one issue he may have success in what is also within human rights field is a very fast-growing field of digital rights and freedom of expression online. It's also been very interesting, the other domestic issue he has he's been very willing to stake out his stand is the so-called culture wars in Iran. And there was a recent episode just this last month that exploded on the international stage, which very much demonstrate what this culture wars on. And what it was about a month and a half ago, a video appeared on YouTube made by a group of young college students in Tehran. It was a dance video to the sound of a popular music called Happy by Pharrell Williams, if you're familiar with it. And they called it Happy in Tehran. They called it Happy in Tehran. And I'm going to show you actually a clip of it to just get an
idea.
This is why I came to lunch. Yes, this is we're going to start on a happy note.
Yes.
So they called it Happy in Tehran, and let's watch a brief opening of it. Okay. So it goes on, it's long. But the key observation, first of all, this video went viral when it was posted on YouTube. There were a couple hundred thousand hits on it within a few weeks. And what it really demonstrated, the majority of population who voted for Rouhani, it showed their aspirations, their hopes, their happiness that the future looks bright. Actually, there is a message they put at the end of it, saying that we hope the outside world realizes that people in Tehran are happy. And here we are, and we're, you know, because Pharrell Williams had called on his fans to make this video everywhere. They were made in Beirut, in Kuwait, in Europe, everywhere. And this is the Tehran contribution.
Yeah.
This really did, and remember, these kids are all 25 or under, so they really were first-time voters, in a way, when Rouhani's election took place. And it represented their hopes and aspirations. And it turned out later, we found out the director of the video was very active in Rouhani's campaign. Actually, he's credited for having come up with the campaign color, purple. Purple became last year the main color that all of election promotion of Rouhani was used. So they had a very direct tie with him. Then about a month ago, our very own colleague, a political satirist, Iranian political satirist, who's also referred to as John Stewart of Iran, he works with us, and he also has a weekly TV show he makes in Brooklyn and airs over satellite to Iran. About a month ago on a Friday, in his show, he had a segment about happiness in Iran and showed parts of this clip along with other footage from inside Iran. By Monday, following Monday, these kids were all arrested. The police had gone after them, arrested them. By Tuesday, They were on national TV, so let's watch the same dancers, which here they refer to as actors, but they're not really actors. The TV, Iranian TV, called them actors. But they were brought in humiliated, shamed, and forced to apologize, express remorse. And we, actually, our organization documented firsthand through contacts in Tehran that they were beaten, they were gun was put into their head, they were humiliated, and the interviewer, the TV interviewer, played a very active role in forcing them to make these statements. This is part of the what Iranian TV showed. So as soon as this news came out of Iran, it caused a huge international and domestic outcry, actually within Iran too. And a Twitter campaign that you see the hashtag down there, Free Happy Iranians, was launched. And within 24 hours, it was just simply not justifiable for the regime and the hardliners to keep them. And there is a lesson in there that when there is the international scrutiny together with domestic awareness of what hardliners are doing, they actually cannot hold on their grounds. And they released them. They released them by that Friday. They were out of prison. And again, the police chief you saw in there and the interviewer very much represent that minority within Iran's security and intelligence system who are confronting the majority. And these culture wars are bringing that to the fore. What has happened since the happy incident, we'll call it, is that Rouhani been very much engaging his hardline cleric opponents on these culture war issues. So the next video I'm going to show you is indeed the past 10 days, a series of back and forth on the national stage between Rouhani and hardline clerics. And I think the message in it would be very clear. It's focused on the role of state religion in and private lives of citizens and what is Rouhani promoting and what his hardline critics are arguing back. So just watch. You're going to see Rouhani, then a hardline cleric, then Rouhani responding back a few days later, and then again a hardline cleric.
بذاریم مردم در سلامت روحی باشن. حکومت وظیفه دارد جاده رو هموار کنه برای بهشتی شدن مردم.
Okay, so this is really very tangible demonstration of what are the culture wars. And really what Rouhani getting into is he's addressing a fundamental struggle regarding the role of state and religion in people's daily lives. Because there is really a near schizophrenic relationship between what the state and how the state is enforcing in public certain moral and cultural mores, which is in direct contradiction with how the majority of society is actually living their lives and what are their preferences. And it is coming to the national stage because the hardliners have been forced to cede the nuclear issue to Rouhani. They know that he has the support of the supreme leader and, again, the majority of the country behind him. So they're trying to confront him on this. They're trying to really confirm their own continued power and relevancy by engaging in this behavior. And his willingness, Rouhani's willingness to confront them shows his confidence that he does have the majority of population behind him. And actually, the hope is that the continuation of this debate would lead to a less repressive environment for the majority of the people. Now, as I mentioned, when Rouhani got elected last June, he really brought along a wave of hope and optimism to the country. there was a collective fog of depression over the country during the last few years of Ahmadinejad. First, there was the severe repression and crackdown after 2009, making people feel very helpless against the powers to be, and then the intensification of the international sanction had really destroyed their daily livelihood, and the country was on a downward spiral. His election brought a lot of hope, and what is impressive a year later, when we talk to most of our interlocutors inside Iran of all stripes, he has maintained that sense of hope and optimism. People still believe he will succeed in the nuclear negotiations and more, especially on the domestic front. This is remarkable because the other mandate he had and the other reason voted for him was the economy. And if you look at the state of economy today compared to a year ago and ask, are you better off today than a year ago? For most average citizens, the answer is no. He has managed to stop the downward spiral. Of course, he has got some cash flow from the P5+1 interim negotiation, but the unemployment remains high. The value of Iranian currency compared to the dollar, the exchange rate, which is a very common way for people to measure how better off they are or not, it actually has not changed at all. It is very much what it was when he came to power. The working class is still struggling very much, and their grievances on paid wages, factories closing, that is continuing. But what Rouhani administration has also made very public is its findings of immense corruption and fraud under Ahmadinejad. And that has given him cover and a bit of breathing space as it tackles problems that are not of its own making, and people realizing that how bad the situation was. Indeed, within a month of coming to power, he announced that the treasury is empty. They had looted the treasury. There was not much cash left. And the hardliners criticized him for announcing that in public, and they said that almost is treasonous because now the outside world knows how bad our situation is on the cash front. But overall, this has resulted in a more favorable political environment for him, and it is again notable that his opponents have not been able to galvanize any major opposition to his policies. And he still remains popular. Now, on the civil society front, even though I mentioned that the human rights violations have continued or increased, but there is some opening. We're seeing because under Ahmadinejad, civil society organizations were completely demolished and uprooted, and they're starting to take root again. Women's organizations, student groups, environmental activists, actually the environment is coming up as a major civil society concern for very serious reasons too. They're starting gingerly and slowly to come together and become active again. The most tangible sign has been the fact that university students are no longer expelled and banned from education because of their political views. And indeed, the student and faculty who were expelled under Ahmadinejad as a very systematic policy have begun to return to universities. And people also are starting to feel the beginning of end of international isolation because there are many foreign delegations and academics going to Iran, and people-to-people interactions are increasing. And that is very welcome by most people. So, in addition, civil society is very mindful of what happened last time we had a reformist president, Mohammad Khatami. During his second term, he pretty much lost the support of civil society because he had raised expectations and had promised structural reforms that he could not deliver. And during his second term, people, especially civil society activists, stopped supporting him. And they saw what that brought along was the rise of Ahmadinejad administration. So this time they are somewhat reluctant to undermine Rouhani, especially after 1 year, and are giving him more benefit of the doubt. And finally, The final point I would make about what this, is significant about Rouhani and his presidency during this 1 year is his ability to work the Iranian political system and especially get the supreme leader behind him on his foreign policy rapprochement initiative. During the past 25 years, we've had three other presidents since the 1991 presidency of Rafsanjani, Khatami, then Ahmadinejad, each of them 8 years, who tried to form their own independent foreign policy rapprochement toward the West in their own style, and they always ran into problem with the supreme leader, and eventually he blocked them from any further progress. Here, within 1 year, Rouhani has shown his talent to master the intricacies of Iran's political system and keep the supreme leader on his side. And that has has meant that he's has support of the supreme leader for now. And this rapprochement and negotiations going on could really turn a page in Iran's foreign policy. So let me stop and open to discussion, but I just want to make one key observation as a conclusion of summing up all these things, and that is that Rouhani has demonstrated he has a vision for the country in ending its international isolation. He has been actually saying in Tehran over and over for the past few weeks that the nuclear agreement is just the beginning of ending this isolation. And that means to us that it opens a very unique window of opportunity, unprecedented over the past decade, for promoting human rights in Iran. Because ending that isolation, we must tie it to improvement in the domestic situation and the human rights. Iran cannot fully integrate back to the international community if its government and its security apparatus treats its citizens the way it has been. And that's a message that has to be given to Rouhani and Khamenei, and indeed it will empower Rouhani too, because as we notice, he is engaged in some of these rights issues, and it was part of his election mandate. So the more he's capable to fulfill them, the stronger his position is. And indeed, it would have a positive feedback for the nuclear negotiations, both in getting the deal and implementing and sustaining it. Because the stronger he is at home, the less likely his hardline opponents can undermine him. And that is very much a reason why Iran's civil society and human rights community is very much behind him on reaching an agreement. They want to see an agreement, and they want to move forward. And yet we see it also as a very positive opening for us to tie this integration and ending isolation with improvements on the human rights situation. And that is unprecedented, at least over the last 10 minutes.
Thank you so much. So the floor is open. Mickey first, and Sarah.
Well, thank you for this overview. It's part of why I personally support, and I think the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran is so important, because that message that you cannot separate human rights from the nuclear negotiation for decades, we've seen, and not just in Iran and North Korea and other places, that human rights could be pushed to the side or even over the edge when there was a nuclear discussion or negotiation underway. So I think that's an absolutely essential message. And there have been some real high points over the last year, but also some low points. A high point, Nasrin Sotoudeh being released after years so she could rejoin her family and young children. Low points, the happy video. That exploded on Twitter, and I want to compliment you in getting a retweet from Pharrell himself. I think getting a retweet from getting Pharrell involved in human rights in Iran is a real achievement of the campaign, and I want to salute that. And my question is really this. I know you say this is the key moment, and there is leverage and there is a chance to include, to keep human rights on the agenda. But, you know, I presume Rouhani will come for the UN, you know, UN General Assembly, that there'll be another moment where the international community can weigh in. So what role for the international community, and when, to really turn up the heat in relation to human rights without having the opposite of the intended effect and strengthening hardliners?
That's a very good point, because some of the people who want to see a diplomatic rapprochement with Iran say that, well, we can't really put human rights on the table because that would weaken Rouhani.
Right.
And complicated, and, you know, then he has to be accountable for actions that he has no power or decision-making role in. But as I mentioned, he himself has taken on several rights issues, whether it's the internet, whether the cultural and social issues. I believe that we can take the cue from himself and his administration and see what are the struggles he's involved in on the rights front and echo those back as demands of the international community. And that would reinforce his position at home and make it also much more logical for him to call for those changes inside the country. I think we can take the cue from him and his own administration. And of course, the other argument would be that, you know, if Iran wants to fully integrate and end its isolation, it has to respect its international commitments, not just on NPT, for example, but on the human rights treaties it has signed. And our own evaluation from talking to people close to Rouhani is that, of course, if he had a free hand, he would try to move in that direction, but he needs the push. He needs to have a reason for going to the table with Khamenei and saying, we have to take steps in this direction. And that international attention, particularly coming at this moment from all the interlocutors involved with Iran, would give him that ability.
I have a question about the recent developments in Iraq, mm-hmm. and the, you know, sort of preliminary discussions with the U.S. About security collaboration on that. What are the power dynamics that plays into, and does that help or hurt the human rights question, especially, you know, generally speaking, I think the U.S. track record in collaboration on security issues with foreign countries right. tends to lead it down a bad path, and I'm wondering what you see there for Iran.
It is really early to see what is the impact of it, given that it is a very complicated issue. It has the potential of blowing up to a full-fledged regional war between various actors from Saudi Arabia, Iran, and then the Western countries, what position they would take. I think in short term it's positive in the sense that may bring Iran and U.S. actors closer to each other. They find common ground and they see their interest in the region overlaps more than diverges. But I don't see, you mentioned that usually when U.S. has security agreements or collaboration with other governments, it does not help the internal issues. I don't see that extent of cooperation coming up. I don't see American advisors and, you know, Iranian Revolutionary Guard commanders working hand in hand. So hopefully we won't see that tradition.
And that's good.
That's good. We don't want to start having, you know, black ops or black sites in Iran for ISIS members or things like that. But I do worry if it really becomes a Shia-Sunni war. It will empower the Revolutionary Guards in Iran more and actually may give it popular support too, because what ISIS is saying and the kind of ideology it's promoting and kind of practices it's putting in place in the territory it has captured, it does really frighten all Iranians that it's coming to their doorsteps. And that would mean that civilian rule in Iran could be weakened if we see basically a full-fledged war that Iran is a party to and or has to hold its ground at its border. But short-term, we have to really see whether U.S. decides to fully engage again in Iraq militarily, or it may want to see Iran do more of its work there, but I don't see the two security institutions in each country starting to cooperate that closely to have the usual American negative feedback that you mentioned. But it's a very wild card and really came out of nowhere.
Hadi, what makes you think that, let's say, if a nuclear deal were reached and it were, obviously Iran will only sign it if it decides that it's in its interest, that Rouhani would use the political capital that he earned for domestic reforms? What evidence have you seen in his policies or communications or maybe through quieter channels that you think that that's even a reasonable hope?
Well, part of it is just the very fact that the nuclear issue as a foreign policy crisis has eclipsed the domestic issues. And much of the domestic actors who want to test him, for example, whether he will be willing to move on these issues or not, whether it's him, Ahmadinejad, or any of the people who have been in power, it just been such an overwhelming presence of this crisis that has always pushed other issues aside. So one of the arguments is that once there is this agreement, then we can really focus on domestic issues and have a conversation about what the situation is. He has, again, given enough indication that he will move in that direction, whether it's about censorship or personal freedoms. The thinking is that right now, if he gets the agreement, then he will be strong enough in a strong position to start pushing and confronting his domestic opponents more. But I agree with you. He doesn't have a track record in public before becoming president. So we can look at him and say that, well, where was he on these various domestic issues throughout these 35 years? He actually was not a public person, so there is very little to know what he truly feels. But just to give you another example, which for this Iranian cleric is very unusual, when the World Cup began last week, and Iran has a team there and played its first game, he posted a picture of himself on Facebook, completely in regular clothes. I don't know how many of you have seen it, without his turban.
That went viral.
He's wearing the jersey of the national team,
hanging out
in front of his TV in his living room. So he's very much giving the message that I'm one of you to the general population. And I think that for his legitimacy and popular support to continue, he will have to start to address those issues. But you're correct. We don't know enough about him, or he hasn't invested enough of his capital in actual tangible programs and policies.
Maybe there are people around him. So in the foreign policy side, obviously, when he brought Zarif back to be foreign minister and those people around Zarif, obviously the administration is not one man. And so there, in the case of the foreign policy circles around him, he's really brought in people who have a lot of credibility and a track record internationally. Domestically, when you look around Rouhani and you look at different ministerial appointments or lower down or other advisory roles around him, what do you see that encourages you, or what do you and your colleagues hear that encourages you that some kind of reform might be the next step?
It is difficult. He has not. One thing I should make very clear that his policy circle or his advisors, ministers, are not a continuation of Khatami's era. Actually, very few people who were active in the political administration of Khatami's era are in his. He's brought a whole new team. He's brought a whole new team. What is interesting, many of them, what we used to call hardliners 10, 15 years ago. And Ahmadinejad's rise has actually moved them to the center. So they have become vocal critics of the current hardliners. And as you saw in those short clips, some of these hardliners are really off the mark. I mean, they're saying things which are medieval, and actually I didn't get that footage. Rouhani's last reference to them was that they belong to the Stone Age, and they have their mentality has not developed. I think he will engage in domestic reforms, and I agree with you. It's a speculation. It's my opinion. I don't have enough evidence in his behavior or actions to support it. But one thing I can say for sure is that he's a shrewd politician, and he realizes to hold on to his political power, he needs popular legitimacy. And he cannot lose the support of the masses who brought him to power. And he will begin to move on domestic reforms, even if he doesn't believe in it, for the sake of holding on his political position and popularity as he goes toward the next election cycle. And a major, major event gonna be in about 14 months' time, not March of next year, the following March, when we're going to have parliamentary elections. And how much he will try to have like-minded people enter the parliament. Right now he's dealing with a parliament that is from Ahmadinejad era, has no popular legitimacy. The election of this group of MPs was completely staged. And just to look in the horizon, there is another very important development, which is the election for what is called Assembly of Experts. These are a group of people who will appoint the next supreme leader if this one, for any reason, were to die or become, you know, but I think his natural death probably is the only scenario. But there is a lot of eyes focused on how that, who will get onto that assembly of experts. And again, I think Rouhani has very clearly been on the side of people who seem more moderate and willing to consider change, for example, of not having a single supreme leader. What has been very hard for majority of Iranians to swallow is the fact that they rose up in 1978 to overthrow a monarchy, and they were very proud to have finally removed 2,500 years of a tradition of a single man's rule with a republic, only to find out that the concept of supreme leader, religious leader, will come in, and this present supreme leader has really put himself back in the form of a king. He's called himself the absolute supreme jurisprudent. And I would say even with much of the political class of the Islamic Republic, they like to see domination of a single man over the entire political system to go away. And Rouhani will probably play a role in bringing about that transition. But you're right. I cannot point out to any specific minister or people that we could compare to Zarif, for example, and say we know where this person stands. I would say these are people who themselves are in transition and being transformed politically with regard to how they see future of the country. And Ahmadinejad's rule helped a lot in bringing about that transformation in their thinking and
that's the only nice thing I've ever heard you say about Ahmadinejad.
Yeah, that he made former hardliners to become centrists,
basically. I have a question, Bobby. I was interested in your analysis of why internet freedom has moved forward, and yes. I'm wondering if you could say a few more words about economic development and how we might use that as a peg to move other things forward, right? I mean, the internet is one form of it's a platform for expression. But how can we sort of make those links more explicit, or get his allies to make those links more explicit?
On the other rights issues, I mean, basically whatever I think that can be, the workers' rights, of course, has been the something that we can very clearly tie, and there is a large constituency inside the country who is working class, or who was middle class, but during Ahmadinejad's years became working class. So I would say on workers' rights there's opportunity, and on women's rights, mm-hmm. I think, when it comes to and Rouhani himself has also referred to it, when it comes to participation of women in society and employment. Again, that will tie into economic activity, employment, and it probably be much easier for him to sell it to a more traditional religious oriented constituency that he may have to argue with. But I see those two issues, some things that can become also tied to development issues.
What is the situation with the cinema and the censorship? And because I select films for a film festival on human rights, and we get quite a few films from Iran, surprisingly many, mm-hmm. considering what's happening inside.
Well, that was one of the very first concrete acts he did. During Ahmadinejad's last year, there was an independent house of cinema, literally called House of Cinema, which all the cinema directors and professionals were engaged in, and Ahmadinejad shuttered it and tried to start one that was completely dependent on the state to control content and production of films. One of the first things Rouhani did, which we thought would be beginning of opening up on freedom of associations, was allowed the original House of Cinema come back. And when he holds meetings, public meetings, he makes sure that a lot of cinema people are around him. That's very interesting. He just had the 1 year anniversary of his victory, and all the prominent, well-known actors, actresses, directors were invited to sit on the front row. His Ministry of Culture, which is in charge of censorship, has not yet opened up this space, whether it's for literature, publications, or cinema as much. But what is interesting about Iran is that also with music, underground music, people go on anyway and make their product. Of course, they take a big risk, but there's a huge underground music scene. So I think with cinema, that creative energy will continue to demonstrate itself one way or another, and that's why we're getting so many films made.
And they're screened.
Yeah. They're not films that are made without a permit, but they make it to international film festivals and get recognition abroad usually. But honestly, I cannot tell you for sure what is the situation with issuing permits for films, because I have seen culture people, whether it's literature, music, or cinema, mostly complain about obstacles that have not been removed yet.
Another question, just about what the potential future role of civil society is going to be, and what role the expatriate Iranian human rights community is going to play, how much preparation there is for people maybe trying to venture back, and what the environment is, or how to prepare the ground to have a civil society to absorb some of the new freedoms and to start exercising them.
So civil society, I think, is going to be very important, because we basically have a generation of Iranians who grew up with the promise of civil society being a major part of the society. Khatami's era from 97 to 2005 talked a lot about civil society. So generally, people recognize that government cannot solve all problems. And one of the domains where it's become very clear is the environment. Iran is facing environmental disaster on many fronts, whether it's air quality, water, several serious environmental issues that have led to grassroots environmental organizations forming who are, and it's similar in China kind of too, that when people start to see the impact of developments on their lives, they're not going to wait for the government. They're going to try to find solutions. The expat, so there were civil society organizations formed under Khatami. They were uprooted under Ahmadinejad. And then after 2009, we had a huge exodus, people forced into exile. They are going to play a very important role because they have maintained their networks inside the country and actually try to empower and provide capacity to their colleagues back in the country. I've been very impressed with people who have left. They're constantly looking to provide, whether it's, you know, and because of sanctions, especially people inside the country can't do many basic things. So it's their friends abroad who are doing it for them. Originally, when Rouhani came back to power, a lot of people started packing their bags and thinking they will be going back. But the hardliners made it clear it's too early. But eventually, I think the expat community will play a huge role because they have gained a lot of experience also from the societies they've lived in, and they've kept their networks in Iran, and they will be transferring it back. But we're not quite there yet.
There's another question about the regional situation in Syria. I mean, so far Iran has been pretty hardline in terms of its support for Assad as a red line and supplying the bulk of the weapons and for Syria. Do you think as they negotiate over the future of Iraq, there might be any more flexibility in terms of their posture on Assad and Syria? I mean, is propping up Iraq more important to them than Syria at this stage, do you think?
Well, I think now they're tied. If anything, with the events in Iraq, they're going to be more interested to keep Assad's regime in place. It'd be very risky for them to suddenly start being flexible on Assad. I'm afraid. I think, again, Americans going to look at the situation in Iraq and, the question is if Assad goes right now, what will replace it? Now, again, it's not about the, I think Iran is ready, is not married, or the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, that's really the one who has empowered Assad, is not married to him, as a personality to keep. But they're interested to keep his infrastructure in place because of the chaos that would ensue. I think actually with the events in Iraq, and what I really see is the contours of claims for a new country in the region approaching. If they solidify their gains, there could be very complicated situation because the Kurds immediately will declare independence. And there will be a new Sunni or a claim to a new Sunni country in northern Syria and Iraq. If you look at the cities that ISIS has taken over, they've been very systematic and they're really redrawing the map in Syria and Iraq. So actors like Iran and the U.S. are going to be very worried of further chaos. And that's the really sad thing, that despite all the atrocities and tragedies Assad has caused, things are turning to his favor with this new developments, I would say.
And so I had one follow-up on the point you were making earlier about the election, the nomination of the Supreme Leader in this new council, the council being selected.
Yeah.
How does that happen? Who nominates or elects them?
Well, that's the thing. Even though we have elections in Iran, who becomes a candidate is extremely staged and controlled. So you're going to have basically clerics, mostly they're clerics. Actually, I think they all are clerics who are elected to this assembly of experts. And people will vote for them, but there is not going to be, you know, that much competition or freedom to become a candidate. And then this 80 or so clerics will form the council that will decide if the Supreme Leader for any reason was to die or become incapable of fulfilling his role, they will decide the next one. But what has become very clear is that there is no single cleric or ayatollah who can fill that space. And the Constitution had already predicted that there could be a council of three of them ruling. And that is the transformation that I think Rouhani is going to contribute to.
I had one last question, because I know Anthony has a hard stop. But and that is, you know, I'm to talk us through the full range of products that the international campaign produces, because I'm always astonished at the range of different things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know what you produce for the Western media, because if you pick up the New York Times, any story about Iran always cites the campaign and often quotes you. But can you talk us through the range of other things that you're producing in different languages and what your, you know, what the resources are that are available are? You mentioned the TV show.
Right. So everything we do is bilingual, in Persian and English. We really wanted to have Arabic, Turkish, Portuguese, and Spanish products too, but it was a little too ambitious. We did have a Portuguese website for a while for Brazil that did lead to a good outcome in getting us a footstep inside Brazil that continues to this day. But beside the regular news and research and documentation, which leads to the traditional human rights reporting, we have moved a lot in the direction of multimedia. So we produce videos, whether advocacy videos or even a music video on executions. We had a very prominent rap artist.
Sounds like you weren't aware of that.
No, I showed it to you, the execution. So a prominent rap artist, Iranian rap artist, who recently came to exile and sees himself as an agent of social change, came to us and said he wants to produce a video. And when he brought the lyrics, I was very impressed. It really was right on target. And, you know, for a human rights organization to send its message through rap lyrics was sound like a risky business. But I guess poetry is in the blood of Iranians. It really was right on the mark. And you can see it on YouTube. We released it in November. It has had about, our own posting has had 125,000 hits. And somebody else reposted it on YouTube, which has had over 80,000 hits. We do, actually, I would say the most important product we have right now, we have a direct line of communication with the Iranian people every week on Thursdays, which is today. The political satirist I mentioned out of Brooklyn, he began, before doing his TV show, making a podcast for us, half an hour weekly human rights podcast, which originally was online and now is being aired into Iran over shortwave radio. So we value that immensely, because now we have direct line of communication to millions of people.
It's really news with a human rights lens.
Right? It is.
And if people are interested to learn more, they can sign up for the update, the weekly update. Yes,
we have a weekly update. If you're interested, visit the website, sign up, and
give you a card.
I don't know if you wanted to ask any questions. I'm interested. I mentioned in opening that probably both sides, the supporters and the opponents of a deal between Iran and the P5+1, in particular in the United States, could see the value of having an endorsement for their point of view from a group like the campaign or those who are like-minded, concerned about human rights defense in Iran, because being able to point to that kind of issues, and it's going, you know, with their respective arguments, could be really helpful to them. So that puts you and your campaign in a influential position, because the deadline for a for the process to deliver a result is in about a month from now. So how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, with regard to that, we very much follow what is the main human rights community in Iran. How do they see this agreement hurting or helping them? As I mentioned, they are very much in favor of it. They generally believe that ending the country's isolation is very good for them. And we support the agreement. We actually would be very welcoming of it, but we would insist that, again, full integration must be involving improvement of the human rights situation. We absolutely do not want this nuclear crisis come to an end and people forget about Iran and, business and trade resume just like any other country. This is a serious leverage we see. We have both to end the nuclear crisis and put the human rights on the map. And we definitely also, I think I mentioned at the end, do not support people who want to undermine the negotiations by highlighting the human rights situation or using it for their agenda. And again, it is not an ideological opinion we have formed. It is on the ground, people who are trying to improve the situation are telling us that's the way forward. That's what will help us.
Yeah, so we'll be watching for letters, statements, and positions that you and others...
Right now, in the process of interviewing major activists and opinion makers and dissidents inside Iran, asking them, what is your take on the negotiations? And if an agreement is signed, would you be welcoming it or not? And how would it impact your concerns? We did that 2 years ago when we were at the height of the fever for military action against Iran. And we found that, unanimously, all the dissidents inside the country oppose military action. They cannot see that helping their cause at all. And that's somewhat confounding to some people who have worked with dissidents in other countries and usually see dissidents want to jump in and use any pressure point against the government they're fighting.
Right. Those people who would want to see human rights instrumentalized as a means of regime change and so on would be... Yeah.
Washington's full of them.
That's right. They'll be probably quite disappointed. Well, I think this is a good place maybe to leave it today, but with the deadline coming up next month and the General Assembly this fall, there's a lot of reason for people to be following what the campaign is doing. So I'm really delighted that you were able to present such an insightful presentation to us and to give us the chance to talk with you today, Hadi.
Well, thank you all for coming.